Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in spaceflight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the February 23rd, 2013 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Hey, welcome aboard as we settle in for another hour of discussion about our nation's space program. And focus this week on some behind-the-scenes activities and events that, in my opinion, just continues to offer proof that our space program remains active in this nation and around the world. On today's program, I'm going to offer up some comments on several things that were in the news this week when it comes to space flight. Then we'll hear from Russell Cox of Flexure Engineering about an interesting conference scheduled to take place in Cocoa Beach here this April. And later, we'll talk with a gentleman who is working hard to establish a new cable television channel dedicated to all things related to air and space. Plus, we'll tell you about this Friday's planned launch from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. And as always, we welcome and appreciate any thoughts, questions, or comments you might have about what we're discussing or anything having to do with our space program. Give us a call by dialing 321-768-1240. Or if you prefer, you can send us an email. The address is spacetalking@aol.com. Okay, now it's time for our more or less weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. There was another report in the news on Friday of a fireball in the sky over Southern California. The glowing green object was caught on camera as it burned up, with the spectacle lasting just a few seconds. When I read of the incident, I smiled to myself, not really because of the actual news, but because of the way it made news. The story is another example of the kind of journalism that annoys me to no end, helped prompt me to quit being a reporter more than 8 years ago, and concerns me now because of how stories like this could affect the public's perception of our space program. Whether it's space-related or not, you do see these kind of stories after every major national or international event as local media outlets scurry to find their own example of the same thing happening, well, locally. For example, if there happens to be a big airplane crash somewhere, surely a tragedy, but then for the next few days, we will hear about every little hiccup at the local airport in which a pilot has trouble, but then safely lands without anyone getting hurt. And then the reporter says this incident follows on the heels of a bunch of other non-news-related events that they then list, and of course wrap up by including mention of the big plane crash. You can almost bet that after the report, the news anchors at the desk will look at each other and then say something that will suggest, in sort of a flippant and certainly doomsday manner, that it appears no one is safe when they fly, even in our little town. I think now we're seeing the same sort of media phenomenon with meteors shooting through the sky. A week ago, as you know, a 150-foot-wide asteroid flew past the Earth at a distance of more than 17,000 miles. On the same day, a much smaller space rock slammed into the atmosphere over Russia and set off a shockwave that damaged buildings and unfortunately hurt more than 1,000 people and made international headlines, as it properly should, given its historic nature. Problem is that since then, every little harmless and common streak in the sky that was caught on camera has been reported by someone on TV as though the sky is now falling and proving once again that it's only news if you have pictures of it. I was particularly amused by the reports last weekend of a meteor seen over South Florida that got the whole bunch of uninformed masses down there in a tizzy, thanks to all the local news media who reported the story as though they had just realized meteors can appear anywhere at any time. The reports prompted all sorts of responses on Twitter that were published as part of the news reports, including one guy who tweeted, "Now a meteor flew over Miami? What's going on in the world? Freaked out." Imagine how badly that guy would be truly freaked out while watching one of the meteor showers that normally takes place every year, or even if the Miami Marlins actually won a baseball game. Well, there is another old saying in media circles that says, whether it's bad news or good, just spell my name right. So perhaps it shouldn't matter whether the media gets this asteroid meteor shooting star story straight or not. So long as they're talking about it, we can only hope this increased awareness by the public of what's happening over our heads every day will be helpful as another way to highlight the importance and relevance of our space program to all of our lives. Well, there were two other space-related items in the news this week that caught my eye and I think are worth mentioning. The first has to do with Orbital Sciences' new Antares rocket, which is the booster designed to carry the company's Cygnus cargo ship to the International Space Station. For the first time, an Antares rocket on Friday was test-fired while remaining bolted to its launch pad in Virginia. And the early word is that everything went as expected. Now, that bodes well for the company's plans to launch their first demonstration mission to the space station later this year. You may recall that Orbital Sciences and SpaceX have contracts from NASA to deliver supplies to the orbiting outpost. SpaceX, with their Falcon 9 rocket and Dragon spacecraft, have already begun their deliveries. And now with the Antares and Cygnus, Orbital Sciences hopes to join that club very soon. You may also recall that in deciding where to stage their launch operations, SpaceX chose to take advantage of the existing and unused Launch Complex 40 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Virginia-based Orbital Sciences, meanwhile, elected to bypass Florida's Space Coast, much to the dismay of our local space leaders, and keep their operations closer to home by working with NASA and the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport at Wallops Island to construct a brand new launch pad. Now, while Wallops has supported launches to orbit in the past, it has primarily been home to suborbital sounding rockets of late. But local efforts there to compete with other states and become a home for commercial space operations has begun to pay off with rockets such as the Antares. Friday's apparently successful static test firing is another step toward growing Virginia's share of the commercial launch market and further proof that Florida cannot take for granted its historic role as home to America's premier rocket ranch. Finally, it was announced last week that multimillionaire Dennis Tito, the first space tourist to visit the International Space Station, will be hosting a press conference this week to announce plans for some kind of privately funded trip to Mars that will aim to take place in 2018 when Earth and Mars are aligned in an optimal way for such a mission. The space community is on fire with speculation about what it is exactly that Tito has in mind. Does the trip involve humans or is it just a robot probe? Will it enter orbit around Mars or perhaps just fly by and come right back to Earth? Or might it even land on the red planet? My fellow space cadet Jeff Faust, a first-class guy who knows his stuff, did a little digging and learned that Tito has written a technical paper that is to be presented at a conference in a few weeks in which describes the bare-bones round-trip Mars flyby mission that would include two astronauts. The crew would have to live in what amounts to survival mode for the entire 500-plus-day trip with just enough food and water to get by. It would by no means be luxurious in any way. They'll be lucky if they get to take sponge baths. Imagine two people living together for 18 months while locked up inside a van down by the river with everything they need to survive packed inside and very possibly unable to get rid of any waste that accumulates. It wouldn't be pretty, but it would be historic. This could be one of the most important and sensational adventures in space since Apollo, and I think we should all pay close attention. And that's Orbital Inclinations. Hey, we talked to Russell Cox about lunar science right after this first break. I'm Jim Behnke, and you are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, you know, if we're ever going to return humans to the moon and then send them on to Mars or do any number of more permanent kinds of activities in space, we're going to need lots of new technology to help us along the way. Flexer Engineering is a company with a presence here on the space coast that is helping us develop some of those new ideas for the future, and its head of research and development is Russell Cox. Russell's been on the program before. He returns today via telephone to update us on their activity and tell us about an upcoming conference that's to take place in Cocoa Beach. Russell, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Great to have you on board. Okay, well, let's first of all remind everybody who Flexer Engineering is and what do you do?
So Flexer Engineering is a young startup. We've been around for about 4 years now. And so we began with a couple of engineers working on the James Webb Space Telescope. And the hallmark of that is the James Webb is at very cold temperatures, about 40 degrees above absolute zero is where the instruments work. And then later it turns out that the moon is that cold too. The lunar poles are as cold as deep space because they only face deep space.
Right.
And so it occurred to us that our engineering skills might work on the moon just as they were working on James Webb. And since then it's turned out that those very cold locations are some of the most interesting locations in the solar system. And we have put together some workshops to explore those ideas. And the next one is coming up in April.
Yeah, and talking a little bit more than that, so when we talk about technology, it's super cold temperatures. I mean, is it more than just sensors being able to detect heat, or is that really the gist of it?
Well, the reason a lot of telescopes operate at these very cold temperatures is exactly that. You can see much colder things, and the most interesting things in astronomy these days are very, very distant, and therefore they appear very, very cold. But the kind of news, and it's actually quite big news since about 2009. Before 2009, people thought that most of the solar system was dry and not particularly interesting. And especially after the Apollo missions, most people assumed that the moon was a very hot, dry place. With the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and another impactor that crashed into the moon called LCROSS, they discovered that the lunar poles are, in fact, very, very cold. And because of that, there's water ice there, and there are other kinds of ices there. And then a recent follow-up mission to Mercury has proved that there's, in fact, a bunch of water ice in the poles of Mercury as well. And so now, just in the last couple of years, planetary scientists have decided that the entire solar system is, in fact, very wet. Mars has much more water than anyone imagined. The moon has water. Mercury has water. The asteroids are now believed to have more water than people believed before. So it turns out the entire solar system, including the moon, is potentially far more interesting from both a technology point of view and a science point of view, because water is, one, this historic artifact of how did the universe begin and how did life begin in our solar system. But also, you can turn water into rocket fuel. You can take the hydrogen and oxygen, H2O, and turn it back into oxygen and hydrogen, and that's what the shuttle burns. And so it's very exciting stuff.
And not the least of which, combine that to generate electricity and then the oxygen for breathing air and all of that. But the super cold, so I think the thing that's interesting is the super cold environment that we have to learn to work in to do all of those things, to run the equipment, to operate spacesuits and habitats. Is that all the kind of thing that you're learning how to do and working on to do that in that super cold environment?
Absolutely. Just kind of like in Florida, the habitats will probably be left in the sunlight to be nice and warm and toasty, but there's going to be a lot of mining and other kinds of industrial work that goes on in the shade. Because in these cold environments, not only is the ice in the shade, which is, by shade, I mean 40 degrees above absolute zero, but also, once you create the liquid oxygen and the liquid hydrogen, you're going to want to store it at those very cold temperatures. So you've seen all the ice that forms on the side of the Apollo rockets and the space shuttle. Well, that's because liquid oxygen is about 80 degrees above absolute zero. So once you make these liquid fuels, you're going to want to store them in very cold temperatures. So there's going to be a lot of robotic equipment, a lot of computer equipment that today we don't really know how to build where everything is cold. In fact, just last week I was down there in Florida and was up at Kennedy, and we're going to have a lot of folks from Kennedy presenting at our workshop, and I'm really excited about that. But one of the guys there who works on the liquid hydrogen plant at Kennedy Space Center was saying that even now, most of the pumps and the valves and the kind of infrastructure that they use to store hydrogen, which is at just about 20 degrees above absolute zero, all the equipment is maintained at room temperature. When you're on the moon, you're not going to be able to do that. And so whether it's a lunar fuel storage plant or out in deep space, which is something that people want to do, having fuel depots orbiting the Earth to go and refuel our communication satellites, that lots of people who are talking about these different in-space refueling exercises. In fact, they just did one on Space Station about 6 months ago.
Right.
So this is where they're all heading. And the key thing that they all need to do is learn how to operate natively when it gets very cold and it never gets warm.
So now let's take it up to the Lunar Superconductor Applications Third International Workshop. It's a mouthful. It's taking place in Cocoa Beach, April 9th to the 11th. What's this conference all about? Who's coming and why do you need to have it?
Thank you. Yeah, we usually shorten that mouthful to LSA for Lunar Superconductor Applications. And so the idea is, when I heard the results back in 2009, I said, that sounds really interesting, and it sounds like something that Flexure could get into. Now we're about 4 years down the road. This will be our third workshop. And it's definitely been proven. There's another Florida native company called Advanced Magnet Labs, and they do some of the best superconducting magnets in the world, and they'll be presenting there. So we've definitely proven the idea that there's interesting technologies, superconductors, high-temperature superconductors. For superconductors, 40 degrees is high temperature.
That's right.
And they can do very high power, but in this environment, they're just a natural choice. They're no longer an exotic material. But there's also very low power electronics, very low power analog systems. These could become important even for things like data centers. So just like the Apollo program created a lot of technologies, in particular personal computers and digital computers, that became commonplace 10, 20 years later, I believe these very low temperature technologies are going to become commonplace in space in the next 10 years or so, and commonplace on the Earth another 10 or 20 years after that, and become critical technologies. So there's new science to be discovered, there's new engineering to be done. And as with each year when we do another one of these workshops, it gets deeper. So there's going to be a lot more technology. We're going to get another Kennedy native project called the Resolve mission, which may fly as early as 2017 to the moon. So this is a rover that's going to go dig for ice on the moon. They're going to be presenting at our workshop, and so some of the Kennedy engineers and scientists are going to be talking about the next mission may be a Kennedy native mission. So that's Ames Research Center is doing some of the science, and Kennedy's building the rover and some of the electronics. We're also going to have, who else is coming? Oh, the Astrobotic, which is a Google XPRIZE team, sure, is going to come and present about their all-cold rover. So we're going to do a design challenge with the engineers. Resolve is probably the next lunar rover that's going to fly in maybe as early as 5 or 6 years. And then we're going to talk about Polaris, which is this privately funded lunar polar rover that will probably fly in 5, maybe 8 years. And then we'll talk about a Flexure original idea called the Midnight Rambler, which is this idea of if it never gets warmer than, say, 60 degrees above absolute zero, what can you do? And so now you can use superconductors anywhere you want to. You can use these ultra-low power semiconductor solutions anywhere you want to. And so we're going to have the three comparative rovers, one that that's being built now, one that may be built soon, and another one that probably won't start for 10 or 15 years, but it'll be the ultimate test of these technologies.
Russell, what kind of people are coming? These are cryogenic engineers, electronic folks, mechanical folks, all of the above?
All of the above. One of the goals and objectives of our workshops is to bring together people who typically don't spend a lot of time talking to each other. And before 2009, these four groups, the cryogenic scientists, the cryogenic engineers, and the lunar scientists all had no particular reason to talk to each other. So we try to create a really collaborative and interesting interactive environment. These are all world-class scientists, so some of the top lunar scientists, some of the top rocket scientists and rover scientists. So these are technical folks, but we're going to have some of the presentations will be done on the web. We also are beginning also to add private space. So we're going to hear from Shackleton Engineering, a private company that wants to mine water on the moon. We're going to hear from Planetary Resources, which wants to do asteroid mining. Mm-hmm. We're going to hear from a Google XPRIZE team, Astrobotic. We're going to hear from Kennedy Space Center about their cryogenics lab. And then we're also going to have a bonus day about lunar cubes, which is the next generation of CubeSat, which we're trying to take that standard. And so these are real small, little satellites about the size of a loaf of bread. In fact, one of your local high schools, Maryland High, right, is building a CubeSat to go into low Earth orbit. We're talking about how do we get that same sort of technology that high schools and universities can build and push that out to the moon, too.
Russell, it's just—it's a great thing that you guys are doing. I know it's not a conference that you can that the public can really go to or even get anything out of. I couldn't understand half of it myself, but it's important to note that this kind of stuff is taking place. We're preparing for the future, and this kind of work is being done right here at Kennedy Space Center. Thanks, Russell, for being on the program. Good luck with the conference, and I know we'll check in with you after it's over with. Okay?
Absolutely. Thank you
All
very
right,
much.
Take care, Russell. Okay, there he goes. Russell Cox, Flexure Engineering. Hey, we're going to pause now. We'll take our five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. When we come back, we'll be joined by Philip Hurst and talk about the possibility of a new cable channel dedicated to all things aviation and space. I'm Jim Benke. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Benke.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk here on WMMB. Once again, the phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments. The phone number is 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@aol.com. Hey, before we get to our next guest, a couple of surprise guests in the studio with me today. My 13-year-old niece, Alyssa, my 11-year-old nephew, Tommy, are here in town from on Florida's West Coast. Their dad's involved in an Air Force activity over at Melbourne High right now, and so they thought they'd come by and try not to fall asleep while listening to the show. And Alyssa, did you want to add anything to the program? You want to say anything? No? Okay. Tommy?
No.
No? Okay. Sorry. There we go. That's it for them. It seems like there is a cable channel available covering every topic possible, and despite having hundreds of channels to choose from, it still seems like there's nothing good on TV. When it comes to aviation and space, you'd think there's a channel for that too, but despite the fact that other networks have programming that does cover the topic, there really isn't a channel dedicated to every aspect of the aerospace community. My next guest is working to change that by launching a new cable channel, tentatively called, I guess, Air and Space TV, and it's an effort that I do fully endorse and support. Philip Hurst is on the phone with us from his home in Orlando and is here to tell us all about it. Philip, it's great to finally have you on the program.
Thank you, Jim. Great to finally be here.
Yeah, we've been talking for a long time about this, and I'm glad that you're able to be on the show today and talk a little bit about it. Let's get everyone up to date. First of all, you're not a quote-unquote space person. You come from a different world out there. Give us a little bit of your history and your background and tell us about how you got interested in all of what you're doing.
Sure. I'm not a space cadet per se, but I play one on TV, or at least hope to in the near future.
Right. That's right.
It all started for me back when I was growing up. I spent a good bit of time in D.C. I actually lived there for 7 years and was fortunate enough to, seemed like hundreds of times I went down to that Air and Space Museum and never got enough of it. The stories always fascinated me, the people, the hardware, the astronaut ice cream, the whole bit.
The whole thing, right.
Yeah, it just kind of always stuck with me. And then a few years ago, I sort of indulged my passion for flying and started getting a license and started putting the whole thing together. What had happened is I was fortunate enough to be the first employee of another niche channel back about 10 or 15 years ago called the Golf Channel.
Right.
And for those that don't know about that, it ended up being, well, it was the first niche sports network out there and was a phenomenal success. Reaches over 100 million today. So I thought, gosh, you know, if we can do this for the game of golf, we need to do it for aviation and space. And I want to, you know, make everybody out there feel the way I felt as a little boy in that museum all the time.
You know, you've been working on this for a while. Just to clarify kind of now what the concept is, Air and Space TV, you know, of course, space is a part of it. You know, it seems like of all the programming that's available, there actually, if you divide it up by percentage, you know, there seems to be a lot more aviation stuff. As sexy as the space stuff is, there's much more aviation programming out there than space programming. And of course, we have NASA TV, which is just NASA.
Right.
We'll talk about your involvement with them in a moment. But give us a sense that if you got this thing up and running, what would be a typical day of programming be like?
Well, look, Jim, it's, you know, when you don't, you're absolutely right that there's probably more aviation programming that's out there. You got to think we've been flying for twice as long as we've been doing space exploration, so that's part of it. But when you start to look at all the movies that are out there, the TV series or the books that have been written, there's quite a body of work on space too. You know, when you talk about a typical day, one of the things that this network will not be is primarily historical in nature. I mean, we're all about, yes, the past, but more so the present and the future. And it's all about compelling television. It's about creating stories and telling those stories and making them relevant and interesting to people. I mean, we could take this show. It's a talk show.
Sure.
And we could take your previous segment and put it on and start showing pretty pictures, and all of a sudden it becomes dynamic, and you know, that's 24 hours a day. It really becomes a you know, a beacon, if you will, for this whole genre.
If you look at the Golf Channel and NFL Network and like you say, the niche sports channels, you know, where you've got documentaries, you've got background pieces, you've got covering live the main big events, which of course would translate here into, like, let's say, launches and air shows.
Absolutely.
And then of course a lot of times there's the news presence. There's the hour news show every night or whatever. All of that part of what is kind of in your vision of what this thing could be?
You betcha. I mean, it lends itself to pretty much all programming types. I mean, we would have a nightly news show. We could easily fill up an hour with aviation and space news and what's going on. We can have competition reality shows, not the cheesy, you know, Real Housewives of Astronauts or anything like that. But
although there's some interesting Housewives of Astronauts, I'll
tell
you.
That's true. And, you know, it's really wide open. I mean, you've got probably 12 Cajun fishing reality pawn shop, et cetera, you name it. And it's really about the characters, and I can't think of a better genre than aviation and space when you're talking about characters.
Why do you think this hasn't been done yet? You know, again, NASA TV dedicated to space, a lot of aviation and space-related stuff as individual episodes of other series on Discovery Channel, Science Channel, National Geographic. But why hasn't someone put this together yet?
Well, you can really say that about anything. It's really a matter of getting it done, and I can tell you from experience, it's hard. It's hard to get a network out there. There's, as you mentioned, hundreds of them. Some of them not doing too well. Some of them have come and gone. Constantly, they're getting changed around, just like radio stations changing formats. But I think that people don't realize, people in the industry have not seen the opportunity for just what, you know, what we call in the industry the category has to offer.
Right. Yeah, we've talked about NASA TV, and that has certainly gone through evolution over the years from NASA Select to the way it is now, and much more production value to it. And it's still primarily a NASA function, NASA organ for getting their word out. There's so much more about going into space than just NASA. But I know that you've talked with NASA TV and have gone back and forth. What do you think is kind of the reaction in the space industry so far to what you're talking about doing?
Well, the reaction to everybody I've spoken with in the space industry is they love it. With regard to NASA, we had a great initial meeting, and it seemed like a really good idea. We were looking to do a public-private partnership and essentially turn NASA TV into a more commercialized channel, putting more money into the programming and kind of augmenting what they have with our television programming experience. And we spent the better part of a year trying to work through it, but I guess the best way I could characterize it is it sort of got mired in the bureaucracy, and
yeah.
You know, we had budget issues and change of administration issues, and at the end of the day, we just decided, well, you know, if it's going to be this difficult to put it together, maybe we should think about another direction.
Another way to do it. I know it's all about the money, of course, and I know you're constantly out there, you know, beating the doors down for money. Not only money, but in terms of the topic, you know, I look at Planetary Resources wanting to go on Asteroid, and Golden Spike wanting to do various things. You've got Dennis Tito about to announce an initiative to Mars. All this new space stuff, SpaceX, all these new guys out there doing things and wanting the publicity and being willing to approach getting that word out in a more unique way than, say, the government NASA TV version of things.
Yep.
Are they all out there on your radar screen, or are you talking to them as well?
Oh, you betcha. They're all on our radar screen. Some of them we've talked to, some of them we have not yet. But I think that's one of the great things about this channel is the potential for what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years and the stories we can tell when the Virgin Galactics of the world start bringing back people that, you know, like me and you, or people like me and you with a couple $100,000 laying around.
Yeah, really.
Can you know, fly to space and back. So that's kind of where we are with that. We're talking to them as much as we can.
And how you go about doing this? Do you start buying transponders on a satellite and just put it up there? Do you go to a cable company, or do you take, like you say, the rebranding of another network and switch it over to something new? How do you go about doing this?
That's the way to do it, Jim. Is the rebranding is really the key these days. It's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to launch a channel from scratch because there's just so many out there. There's so much competition for carriage. What you do is you go out there and you find an underperforming network, if you will, and, you know, again, the analogy to a radio station trying to change the format to get more listeners. There's plenty of struggling networks out there that are looking for something to do, so you're essentially buying the footprint of that channel. So we've got a list of 10 or so networks like that, and we would go out and do an M&A transaction or a joint venture or something like that and relaunch it. And that's how a lot of the recent channels that you've seen come along have been just that. Oprah was Discovery Health and then a few other ones.
Switches over to something new. Philip, stand by for just a moment. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we come back, we're going to check in quickly with our weekly local launch forecast. And then we'll wrap up our conversations with Philip and pose our 5 terminal count questions to this gentleman and find out what his answers are. We'll also get caught up on everything else going on out there, and again, in terms of the next launch and the SpaceX launch on Friday. That's it. Hey, we'll be right back. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. With a reminder, you can stay in touch with us online throughout the week. Your first stop, of course, on the web, WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk. You can find the links to an archive of past Space Talk shows, text versions of orbital inclinations. You can also follow us online with Twitter at Space Talking, and we have a Space Talk page that you can like on Facebook. All right, we'll check in real quick with the local launch forecast. I am happy to tell you that all systems are go, at least at this point, for the launch of a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from Complex 40 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station this week. Liftoff is set for this next Friday morning at 10:10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. This will be an instantaneous launch window, so the Falcon 9 countdown and the weather must cooperate for the on-time liftoff. Of course, we'll see a delay then for 24 hours. Hey, but before we can even get that far, The SpaceX launch team must briefly fire the nine Merlin 1C main engines at the launch pad during a test that is now scheduled for this Monday. A successful static test firing will clear the way for the launch attempt on Friday. The Falcon 9 will be carrying an unmanned Dragon cargo ship filled with equipment and supplies to the International Space Station. If the launch takes place Friday morning, the Dragon capsule will take about 20 hours to reach the station and be berthed by crew members there using the Canadian robot arm. Once again, the launch set for this Friday at 10:10 a.m. Eastern Time. And WMMB, of course, will bring you live coverage of the shot beginning just a few minutes before the clocks reach T0. For more information about these and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com. Keyword Space Talk. Look for the link at the left to our launch forecast. Okay, on the phone with us today is Philip Hurst with Aaron Space TV. And Philip, before we get to Terminal Con, tell everyone real quick, how can they learn more information about what you're doing and be a part of the whole thing?
Well, sure. The basic marketing website is airandspace.tv. I myself have a Twitter feed at Philip with two L's underscore Hurst. That's Hurst with a U.
Okay.
And we have a Facebook page as well.
And it's at this point, it's just all about fundraising, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, needless to say, the larger the venture, the longer it takes, and the more funding. So, while these things are typically very, very well capitalized, they do very well in the end. Certainly, if I did a fraction as well as we did with the Golf Channel with this, I would be very happy.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, Philip. Well, look, we're gonna lighten things up here now, and I'm anxious to hear your answers to these questions. As not being a regular space cadet kind of guy, it is time for Terminal Count, our feature at the end of Space Talk, in which we will ask five simple questions of you to get to know you a little bit better. This is not a quiz. There are no right or wrong answers. This is not a contest, so please, no wagering. All right, Philip, here we go. Real quick, coolest rocket.
Coolest rocket, I'd have to say, I don't know the name of it, but the one that's going to be powering Spaceship Two.
Okay. All right. That's good. That's good. First launch you saw or remember?
That's a tough one. That's going to go back probably 10 years, probably when I first moved to Florida. One of my first night launches, drove all the way over to the end of 50 there and watched my first night launch. It was, I don't know, STS 100 or something.
Something like that, but a space shuttle launch nonetheless.
Absolutely.
Launches, shuttle launches at night were just absolutely the most spectacular of them all. You know, and even when you look at the Atlas V's and Delta IVs lifting off at night, there's still just something different about a shuttle launch. And I know part of it is that there's people on board, but always something to remember. Okay, now this is interesting. I don't know if you've even had a chance to collect anything yet, but your most prized space memorabilia.
Well, Jim, I tell you, I've been looking for that asteroid over Florida, and since it hasn't landed in my backyard, you're right, I'm low on the space memorabilia, but I'd say at this point, the half dozen or so press passes that I did get to go see the shuttle launches up close,
yeah.
To your point, they were just phenomenal.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Okay, now this will be the interesting question for you. Your best space TV series or movie ever made?
Hands down, From the Earth to the Moon.
Oh, really? Ooh, a classic.
Oh, yeah.
I have newfound respect for you. That is outstanding. That is outstanding. You know, by the way, if you ever do Air and Space and TV, when we finally, I shouldn't say if, when we get it on the air,
yes.
You got to get the rights to Don Knotts, the Reluctant Astronaut. There's just no.
Okay, I'll put that one
no
on the list.
No doubt about it. That's my favorite. All right, Moon, Mars, or Beyond?
Oh, well, I got to say Beyond there. I mean, one of my favorite shots is the one that's already from Voyager, looking back at the Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you've seen the solar system view, too, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, with all the pale blue dot and all of that, that's outstanding.
Absolutely. So when you think about how far we've come, you know, as old as we are as a species, and we've only been doing this for 50 years, I think Beyond Mars is very much in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. Philip, we're going to wrap it up with you. Thank you so much for being on the program. I think Aaron Space TV is absolutely something that we in the space community have been asking for and looking for a long time, and I just hope that you can find the support you need to get this thing up and running just as soon as possible.
Hope to bring it to you soon.
That'd be great, Philip.
Thank
okay,
you so
thanks
much,
so
Jim.
Much. All right, we'll talk to you again real soon. Hey, there goes Philip Hurst with Air and Space TV. Hey, I got about a quick minute here, so I'm going to quick ask my niece and nephew. We're going to ask you terminal count questions real quick, okay? If you have an answer, say it. If not, just say no. Coolest rocket, Alyssa?
No.
No? Tommy, do you have a favorite rocket?
No.
No, okay. First launch you saw, remember, Alyssa? You got one? No? Tommy?
No.
No, see, you know, I got to talk. I got to get some videotape to you guys. Most prized space memorabilia, do you got anything, Alyssa?
No.
No? Tommy?
No.
No, see, I knew this was going to be the case. Best space TV series or movie you've ever seen, Alyssa?
No.
No, nothing comes to mind, Tommy?
Apollo 13.
See? Yeah, I did you there. Yeah. Apollo 13. Yeah, okay. And, Alyssa, Moon, Mars, or beyond?
It depends on what beyond is.
It depends on what beyond. Well, would you like it to be Jupiter, Saturn, another star?
I don't know.
You don't know? Okay, Tommy, Moon, Mars, or beyond?
The moon.
The moon, yeah. You wanna go to the moon someday?
Yeah.
Dig out some craters and ice and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. My talkative niece and nephew, Alyssa and Tommy. Okay, well, that's it for them, and that's it for us. Next week on Space Talk, my guest is going to be former Space Shuttle Launch Director Mike Leinbach. We've been after him for a long time. He is now with United Launch Alliance as the director of their human spaceflight operations. We're going to share some shuttle stories with him, and we'll find out what United Launch Alliance is doing to plan for the idea of launching humans into orbit on their Atlas and Delta rockets, how that all might work and how they're preparing for that eventuality. I think it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. Don't forget, we also have the SpaceX Falcon 9 launch this Friday, 10 a.m. I'll be on the air just a few minutes before launch to get you updated on what's going on there. That is it for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck program. We'll be back on the air Friday with coverage of the SpaceX launch. I'm Jim Behnke, and we'll talk to you again real soon.